Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Lav Harkov, senior contributing editor and diplomatic reporter, and I'm here as always with editor-in-chief Yaakov Katz. And this week we have events all over the world to talk about, but I guess we can start. Well, Yaakov, you wanted to tie a bunch of these events together because you were talking about some pictures that really, you know, this is not a visual medium, but we're going to describe for you some interesting pictures from this week.
Well, there were three images, I think, that stand out to a large extent, at least on the Israeli side of the news of the week. The first was when Itamar Ben-Gvir, a member of Knesset, a former Kach activist, a bit of a rabble-rouser of a guy, an instigator, decided to go to the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem, where there is Jewish and Palestinian Arab violence, and set up an office there. It's led to more violence.
Well, he set up his office after there was a fire in the home of Jews who lived there, and
a car had been firebombed as well multiple times. Right. So,
right.
I'm not saying. I mean, we could break it down in a moment. Right. What the reason was, et cetera, but him being there didn't calm things down, right? And we have government officials who are concerned that this could lead to a greater escalation, like we saw about a year ago. Also, Sheikh Jarrah and what that led to in Gaza. Then you have another image the next day of Prime Minister Naftali Bennett traveling to Bahrain, meeting with the Crown Prince, further solidifying Israeli relations with these new Gulf states under the Abraham Accords. And on Wednesday, the Speaker of the House of Representatives of the United States, a very senior official, Nancy Pelosi, is at the Knesset and is leading a congressional delegation here. So you kind of have, on the one hand, Lahav, Israel's diplomatic power, both in Bahrain and in Jerusalem. And on the other hand, you have this guy who is doing things or is part of a larger story in Sheikh Jarrah that could lead to a larger conflict.
Yeah. And I mean, it's scary in a way how you have one Knesset member out of 120, someone whose party does not have enough support for him to get into the Knesset on his own. And yet he could get us all into a huge mess. Now, I don't blame him. I really wouldn't. I mean, if Hamas started rocketing us, attacking us, like using Ben-Gvir as their excuse, then it's an excuse. You know, nothing that Ben-Gvir is doing excuses
it. I agree.
That being said, I mean, everyone knows what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. And he's trying to portray himself as some kind of hero. You know, he collapsed at one point this week. And he's been going around
during scuffles, right?
During scuffles with
security forces and police and, yeah.
Right. Whether he really collapsed or not. You know what? I can't judge. You can't really tell from watching the video, but he says he was attacked and collapsed, and he's been walking around with this bandage on his head, wrapped all the way around his head. And I think that he's trying to portray himself as a hero because the bandage looks suspiciously.
Do you think our listeners know?
Yeah, looks suspiciously like the bandage that Ariel Sharon has on his head in those famous pictures, and
from the Yom Kippur War.
Yeah, from the Yom Kippur War, exactly. And I think that that's exactly what Ben-Gvir is trying to do.
I don't think he even served in the IDF. Because of his
exactly.
involvement.
Because right. I was going to say that Sharon also had a reputation as an instigator for many years, but he also was someone who served his country with great valor. So you can't even compare the two.
Okay, Lahav, you want to take this comparison all the way? Ariel Sharon goes up to the Temple Mount September 2000, and that is what's instigated, according to the Palestinians, right, the outbreak of violence, which then led to the Second Intifada. So,
Right. Although I have to say that argument is one of my pet peeves because Sua Arafat and others in the Palestinian Authority have admitted that they were planning it for months before that. But anyway,
of course,
yes.
A, they were flaming it for months, but B, Arafat had built up an army of terrorists to attack Israel with, right? It wasn't, you know, Ariel Sharon's decision to go visit the Temple Mount was just an excuse that they used, similar to what you just said about what Hamas could potentially do here with Itamar Ben-Gvir's decision to open up an office on the street.
Yeah, I have a trivia question.
Yeah.
I have a trivia question for you. Do you know who went to the Temple Mount with Ariel Sharon?
I'm guessing a lot of security forces, policemen, and you're going to tell me that you were there.
No, Ruby Rivlin was there.
Ruby Rivlin was there.
Rivlin was there, the like lovable grandpa president of Israel years later. But anyway, things are really, really heating up there. And then at the same time, at the exact same time, basically, we have Prime Minister Bennett in Bahrain. First time an Israeli prime minister has visited Bahrain. And just these amazing photos, I mean, and videos of Bennett standing outside the royal palace next to the crown prince of Bahrain, who's also the prime minister. And Hatikva is playing, and you have the military of an Arab country playing Hatikva outside an Arab royal palace. And it's like, who would have ever imagined? Who would have dreamed such a thing?
I mean, you were with Prime Minister Bennett in the UAE. You know, we've seen the Prime Minister travel to these countries, the Foreign Minister. We had Andy Ehrenheim, our military correspondent, with Defense Minister Gantz to Bahrain about a week and a half ago as well. So, I mean, I think I was moved, like you just described, also watching those videos and seeing those pictures. But I also think that, And maybe we just need to stop, you know, to really get excited every time, but it's starting to become normal, right? And that's a good thing. I think that, you know, at the point that we can stop to get excited every time this happens is the point that maybe it's just become normalized, and that's the way it should be, right? People should travel. They should go and meet each other in these different countries.
For sure. I mean, this is the way things should proceed and normally. And I know the Bahrainis felt a little like left out because there's definitely like a huge love fest going on between Israel and the Emirates. And Bahrain is just much smaller, you know, and much, I guess there's fewer business opportunities there. So it was lower priority. So I think for them also, it was important that this meeting have like as much pomp and circumstance as anything that had happened, you know, in Abu Dhabi. But I still think that it's important to look at it and just appreciate, because, you know, it's been a year and a half since the Abraham Accords were signed, a little less, and they were a momentous thing.
For sure. And I agree that we need to continue to value and appreciate what's happening. There's going to be an interesting trip, though, in a couple of weeks. You wrote about this week that Isaac Herzog, Israel's president, will be flying to Turkey to meet with Turkish President Erdogan. It'll be the first high-level visit of an Israeli to Turkey probably since Shimon Peres visited there back in 2007. I accompanied Peres on that trip as a reporter and covered that for the Jerusalem Post at the time. And that was a fascinating visit. And it was so fascinating because Erdogan was actually then the prime minister. The president was this guy, Abdullah Gul, who I think is no longer in government. But they treated Shimon Peres like royalty. And then a year and a half later, right, after Operation Cast Lead in Gaza, that was when Erdogan, you know, stormed off the stage at the Davos World Economic Forum, where he was sharing with Peres.
Yeah. And he said that Israel was killing children.
Correct. And then it just deteriorated. And then, you know, a year and a half later was the Mavi Marmara situation. And then just things went from bad to worse to even worse. And then we've heard the rabid anti-Semitism and anti-Semitism from Erdogan against Israel, against Jewish people. And now things are changing. I mean, what do you think that is about?
I mean, I think Israel always wanted to have like good ties with Turkey. Israel, you know, never instigated any of these things. Now, in Turkey, they've become increasingly isolated. And I think a lot of it is because of Erdogan's behavior. And, you know, he makes threats and ugly accusations. You know, and it's not, I mean, in Israel, there's the anti-Semitism factor, but it's not just Israel. He had very poor relations with our friends in the Emirates until recently, for example. And with France, he picked a very big fight. But yeah, so they feel very isolated. So first of all, they're trying to scale that back and make friends with people again. And so they, for example, have sort of rebuilt ties with the UAE in recent months. And I think the reason for all of that is that their economy is tanking. The lira is doing terribly. And so they need all the friends that they can get. Certainly Israelis, you know, tour less and less in Turkey. It's still, I think, the most popular destination for Israeli Arabs. But Israeli Jews are not, you know, going in the numbers that they used to. I mean, it's very close and very cheap. And also, flights through Turkey are very cheap, but fewer and fewer Israelis are opting to do that, as it seems like a more and more hostile country.
And Israelis used to love going there. That was like their number one tourist destination.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the big thing was like in the beach resorts, to go to these like all expenses paid beach resorts, which is personally not my style, but very popular with Israelis. And they don't do that as much anymore. So I think, you know, certainly if things get better, you'll see a very quick uptick, since we're also getting to the point in the pandemic where I think people are starting to leave the country more. But anyway, Israel is still being very cautious about this, because we sort of see from our experience with Erdogan that he's, you know, very mercurial, and you can't like trust that just because this week he wants to be friends with Israel, that in a year he'll still want to be friends with Israel. So sort of taking things very slowly. Now, I think that Erdogan has used the fact that there's a new government, and also the fact that Herzog is someone who supports a Palestinian state, as a sort of, I don't want to call it like an excuse, but like it sort of makes it easier, because Netanyahu is someone who in a lot of the Middle East, and certainly in Turkey and in the Turkish media, was someone who was demonized. Whereas Herzog is someone who probably the general public in Turkey hadn't heard of before, and then can be presented as, oh, this is, you know, a man of peace who wants peace with the Palestinians, etc. I think it's also interesting that, unlike Rivlin, that Herzog wants to take an active part in Israel's foreign relations and diplomacy. I mean, and Paris, of course, was like that. Paris was extremely active, but it was sort of active in a way that created tension sometimes with Netanyahu. And Bennett has said in a briefing last week, he said in front of all the diplomatic press, that Herzog is a huge help, and that he's very happy and they work really well together. And he's really glad to have Herzog sort of like on the team, smoothing out diplomatic wrinkles for Israel.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, Herzog to an extent plays a bit of the role that Shimon Peres played for Benjamin Netanyahu when he was prime minister. Benjamin Netanyahu was from the right. He had Shimon Peres, who was a known left winger, former Labor Party chairman, known peacemaker, Peace Prize winner, who he could send off to diplomatic missions as well. And Herzog plays that a bit also for Naftali Bennett. Even though Bennett does have Yair Lapid as his foreign minister, I think that Herzog's a brand name. He's a household name. I mean, he's well known throughout capitals, especially in Europe, as well as, you know, with more progressive groups in the United States from his term as chairman of the Labor Party. So he's definitely an asset that they've been using well with one another. And it's to Israel's benefit, without a doubt.
Yeah.
No question.
Definitely.
Lahav, this week on the podcast, we interviewed Tzvika Klein. You want to tell our listeners just who Tzvika is and why we interviewed him this week?
Sure. Tzvika Klein is our new Jewish World reporter. I was very excited to have him on board now. He, for the past 10 years, was a Jewish World reporter in Hebrew for the Hebrew language newspaper Makor Rishon, which is like a religious Zionist or modern Orthodox newspaper, sort of conservative politics. And he was really the leading reporter in Hebrew covering this area of diaspora and Jewish world, and did an excellent job. Has some really great stories, and he's already started, I think, bringing really great things to us. After we spoke to him for the podcast, he reported for the Jerusalem Post about Israel's secret plan for Ukraine's Jews in case of a war in Ukraine.
Right.
To allow any Ukrainian Jew or people who have the right of return, so, you know, at least one Jewish grandparent, to be allowed to come to Israel, even if they don't intend to make Aliyah, even if they don't intend to move to Israel, and, you know, allow them to be here for a time until things settle down, which I thought is interesting. And we talked to him about Ukraine and about the big stories in the Jewish world, and that's coming right up.
So here we go. Tzvika Klein, welcome to the Jerusalem Post.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Lahav and Yaakov.
So this is
my first few hours.
It's your first few hours on the job.
And we're very excited to have you.
I'm excited, too.
And you are our new Jewish World analyst, correspondent, longtime Makor Rishon.
I'm learning how to spell analyst.
Analyst. You learned how to spell analyst.
I'm learning. You taught me that. Yeah.
So, Tzvika, just give our listeners kind of who are you? What's your background?
Where do you come from?
So I say, I really was born in Chicago, but I wasn't raised in Chicago. So I say Chicago, and I know there's lots of Chicagoans here in the Jerusalem Post, which is nice. But so as, you know, I always say I sound American sometimes, but I grew up in Israel. What age? 2.5. Okay. So like I did not choose to make Aliyah. Grew up in Merkaz Klita Ranana, then Ginot Shomron. Large
AKA
group.
Neve Eliza,
yeah. Large group of, I live on Chicago Lane or Road or something.
Are there such a thing?
It's like, it's not official name, uh-huh. But there's a sign up there.
It's like everything else in Judea and Samaria where the government gives it one name, but the people give it another name.
Of course. Exactly. Right. And I was in Dover Tzahal. I was a spokesperson for the Haredi and religious Zionist sectors. You know, they didn't realize I spoke English. That's, you know, our army is very smart in selecting people for certain jobs. And afterwards I was in Shtichut in South Florida. So I know a lot more about South Florida than I know about Chicago, but I play the part,
you know. And then when we met, when yeah. you were working for World B'nai Akiva.
I was a spokesperson.
You were working with my friend Avi.
Right. Yeah. Avi like Zeal. Oh, that's true, right? Wow. When you were in Bar Ilan.
So you were a shaliach, like an emissary.
Jewish agency World B'nai Akiva.
Representative in South Florida.
South Florida.
And then you came back to Israel.
Came back to Israel, and then I worked for the WZO.
Mm-hmm. World Zionist Organization.
Yeah, one of the younger people in the building. I mean, youngest person in the building. Mm-hmm. And for World B'nai Akiva, I did not want to do anything related to media and PR. I like was like, I had enough, but it just kind of came back, and I was a spokesperson part-time also for WZO and for World B'nai Akiva. Sent people on Shlichut, got to, you know, I was single, I got to see countries, go around, and, you know, I was on the plane all the time. And then I got an offer to be a journalist, to work for Makor Rishon, which Shlomo Bensi was the owner back then, so he's a UK.
So what year is this?
2011.
Okay.
And he wanted to establish a news magazine in Hebrew and English. The temporary name, it never happened, it was called The Zionist. It was supposed to be like The Economist, Newsweek, all these types of whatever. Never happened. And someone was like, you know, well, if I was supposed to establish this international news desk. And someone was like, you know, if you want to stay, you better start writing. So that's what I did. And ever
since.
You
know, funny, in 2011, around 2011, Shlomo Bensi made an offer to me.
Really? Okay.
To come work also. He was talking about setting
up.
He
did to many people.
He was thinking about setting up also. He had Makor Rishon. He wanted to set up also an English language platform.
Right.
And he said to me, come be, I was then the military reporter for the Jerusalem Post. Come be the desk editor, the military
desk
editor.
Yeah, he was into desks then.
He called it, you'll be the military desk editor.
Right. I was a desk something, you know.
Right, pay you a little more money.
Right.
In the end, I decided not to go for it because I was trying to get into this fellowship, which I'm getting into.
Good move.
So it was a good move, I guess, in the long run.
Right. And then I met you when you were, you know, working for the government.
Correct.
Right?
But so Tzvika, for about 10, 11 years, you covered diaspora affairs for Makor Rishon. Which made you unique because on the Israeli media landscape, I think besides for the Jerusalem Post, which is kind of movan meilav,
right?
You know, obvious and taken for granted that we would cover
right
diaspora affairs. No one else really does,
right?
In the Israeli
unfortunately,
media. Right. So, what was that like during that period?
It's funny because when I was a publicist, you know, then I got I met Lahav back then. I was like, I always saw the people who were covering diaspora affairs, and I wasn't like, I never wanted to be them. Because I didn't, they were like on the bottom of the food chain and they were like, you know, I don't know why you're smiling. Why are you smiling?
Because I'm thinking that
it's very true.
It's very true. Okay, people just don't care.
I don't know if it was different 10 years ago than it is now, but like now it's usually people who
else. But there were more people.
And then they,
so like as time goes by, there's like less and less, but like there were people actually, you know, like the, you know, IBA, right? Like the Broadcasting Association
Authority
and whatever. Like, I didn't want to be them, but I was like, I know I can do it better than them. But like, who wants to be a journalist there's a food chain and like, right? So you got like security and politics and then prime minister's office and, you know, education's important because everyone's got kids. And like diaspora is on the, you know,
the least, bottom.
Like under, I always say it's under,
you,
under the environment,
but you
know, like
you,
that's the,
but you built up, I would say a, a strong presence within, right. within Macquarie Shunk, right?
So it took me a while to not, to, my brother-in-law, who is a journalist, Yehuda Schlesinger, he's in Israel Hayom. We were friends back in the army in Dover Tzahal, and he says, he doesn't know any English. He's like, Jewish world does a shetose. That's what he said, the Jewish world, ta'bit, you know, and, you know, he probably didn't say it correctly. No one's doing it. That's what you should be doing. And I listened to him, you know, and you know, occasionally I was like, you know, different job offers to write about something else. And I said, no, like this is, and whatever. And I was always wondering, am I like, you know, shooting myself in the leg because I am not, you know, moving forward and doing, you know, writing for other outlets.
But in the end, you've carved out, I think, this huge niche, and you've like made such a name for yourself in the Hebrew media as like the expert.
Bringing attention to issues that, right. like you said, were neglected.
Right. For a long time. So in a way, it's also fun to like fight. I felt like I had to fight on so many levels. It was just at a certain point, it was also, you know, tiring because you have to convince. For instance, you know, Makor Rishon is a right wing conservative newspaper. You can't interview. Head of the Reform movement every other week. You know, there's a certain, like, you know, the fact that I was actually able to was a big deal. We even got into fights with, you know, when Rav Amar was the chief rabbi, and I put in a headline of Rick Jacobs, head of the URJ, of the Reform movement, saying, I asked him, in 20 years, what do you think the state of Reform Judaism in Israel is going to be? And he said, Gilad Kariv will be the chief rabbi. And that was the headline. And
well, he became a Chaver Knesset, you know,
right? Yeah, and head of a committee,
an important committee.
But yeah, that didn't fulfill itself. But you know, I was there with Shlomo Ben Tzvi meeting Rav Amar and like apologizing and you know whatever, and because rabbis were criticizing, you know, the angle we were going in. So it's fun, but you also have to kind of.
I'm curious if you look throughout this thread of time. Right. Since you've, 2011, 2012, since you've been deep into the Jewish world beat, and you look at the relationship between Israel and the diaspora. And one of the things that, that I think we all three of us, as a matter of fact, you, when you were still at Macquarie Shone, but Lahav and I here at the Jerusalem Post, right. The issue of Jews coming into Israel during the time of the coronavirus, when there were the restrictions, we were very outspoken here at the Jerusalem right. Post against it. But you also started this whole online campaign, right. Let My right. People In.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like yeah. Hashtag.
A play on the Pharaoh Let My People Go yeah. thing. So, right, I'm guessing that's where it's from.
Yeah. I hope.
What was the feedback on that?
So it
like within the Hebrew speaking Macquarie Shone conservative right wing
emphasized to myself, I didn't realize how easy it is if you just write in Hebrew, like because the decision makers, you know, want to be, you know, they want the people who are going to vote for them, their constituents, sure. to see what they're doing and to whatever, and then this is not a topic that anyone that you know the majority of Israelis care about, and many Israelis even. Are against letting, you know, non-citizens into Israel. So it's a big deal. And when I started doing it, I was so like mad. I forgot what you know, triggered the last part of it. And I just started creating these JPEGs with the Let My People In. And I got better graphically as time went on. And any minister or like, you know, prominent Israeli had said something, I just created a JPEG. And
with their quotes.
With their quotes. And then
I think I got a quote, maybe. Did I not get one? No,
maybe.
I'm flattering myself.
Maybe. I don't remember. There's a certain point where I was just doing them one after another, so I can't remember exactly. But then, so like, you know, I got, you know, like, so I did one with Buzi Herzog. He didn't like, you know, it was a speech he made, but like he was reacting actually to the campaign. And then Gilad Kariv spoke about it at the committee, so I did another one. And then the ministers started approaching me, and Knesset members were approaching me like, you know, we did this and this and this. I was like, okay. I'll create one for you. And then people were like, how can we join this campaign? I was like, who's running it? I was like, it's not really an organization.
It's just your Twitter.
It's just my Twitter.
Right. But I think what people,
Facebook wasn't even working. I had like a problem. So it was just my Twitter, you know, it was just,
but I think it's a great story because I think what it does show to a large extent is the power of what a journalist can do. And I remember Lahav, you were on a briefing around that same week with the prime minister.
Right.
And you asked him that question, right? Which was, you were the only person everyone was saying, you know, talking
Nobody
about.
Nobody cared about.
No one cared. Yeah. Everyone was talking about, you know, coronavirus right. numbers. And and Iran. And
it was literally a briefing about coronavirus.
Yeah, and you right. asked him about the diaspora, and he gave you an answer how much he cares about it, right? But he's not going to be changing the restrictions. We put that on the front page of the paper. Right. And that also made a lot of noise. So I think, you know, it really is it speaks to how you journalists, right, or us journalists, have to push these issues. Otherwise, no one will care.
Right. And I think also – you know, in an
to
age,
toot our own horn a little,
right? But
know,
no, but
we
in
can
an
do
age,
that once in a while.
But I'll say, you know, to the fact that, you know, we're in an age where there's so much information out there, and so much, you know, if you want to know what's going on, you don't need to go, you know, into the Jerusalem Post unless there'll be some exclusive, right? Exclusive stories, and that's
added value
is when we bring those, you know, breaking and exclusive stories. That's what we bring in because everyone's getting the same messages from the prime minister's office and the ministers. Okay, so you published it up 5 minutes earlier. I mean, maybe Google, that will, you know, be better with your SEO. But at the end of the day, bringing our exclusive stories and our angle and making it different than everybody else's, I think that's what makes it unique.
So what do you think is a story, in a Jewish world story, that not a lot of people are paying attention to that you hope to bring more attention to?
That's a good question. Wow. To think about that. I mean, obviously Ukraine is, but we are following it, but do we understand the Jewish community of Ukraine? You know, it's a very complicated, and you have, you know, your family.
No, well, I don't have family there anymore. It's right. Just
Kharkov is from Ukraine.
Yeah, but Kharkov. It's Kharkov, but they moved to America like 100 years ago. It's right. not, I don't know.
That's why it's Kharkov. Yes.
Right. That's why it's an H and not like, a Kh.
Yeah. And I mean, it's something that, you know, we just had a conversation before we're recording, and like we spoke about, is there a chief rabbi? So there are like many chief rabbis, and it's interesting to see how these communities kind of developed after the 90s. Like Chabad, I would say, is the most important, significant organization there. Obviously, the joint in a certain perspective, but like Chabad is I would say Chabad rabbis are the ones who are leading the communities there. So I think that's definitely a perspective we should be looking into. One thing I think that English readers, the English speaking world doesn't understand enough is what's going on in France, which is fascinating. You know, Israelis assumed that all Jews left France a few years ago, but that's not true. Most of them are still there, like 450,000 Jews.
Right. So isn't it the third largest community or the second largest diaspora?
Well, it depends. I mean, outside of Israel, it's the third. And the Israeli government is actually supposed to be launching some sort of a program, 40 million shekel, through the prime minister's office on Aliyah from France. It's not happening yet. So we're going to have to push prime minister's office to actually make it happen. So that's definitely another perspective. And I don't know. There's just so much going on. I would always, you know, people were like, you know, the Israeli media. So like, what is there to write about every day about diaspora Jewry? I was like, well, I don't have enough time because things are happening. Things are going on.
There's millions of people.
Most Jews don't live in Israel, right? Yeah. So obviously there are many Jewish stories. And I would say is, you know, many people who were Jewish world correspondents were like writing about the Jewish agency and about like these old organizations.
The establishment,
which is nice. And they also are relevant and can bring, you know, good stories. But at the end of the day, I feel like life itself is a lot stronger than any Jewish organization, you know?
Well, I think one of the things that we're hoping you're going to do here at Tzvika is also...
I'm learning, yeah. Everybody gets to hear like my first, you know, conversation with the editor-in-chief,
yeah, so,
right?
So here,
like, this is what we want you to do.
This is what we want you to do. So I think one of the things that we've discussed...
And Lav will tell me what she wants
we have
to
discussed
do.
Is also launching a podcast about the Jewish world and bringing some of those characters to audio for people to listen to. And I think that, you know, as I've watched also the way the Jewish world has evolved over the years. It's so full of color and vibrancy and so diverse. I mean, like even that story that we ran, I think you also did it back at Mokor Rishon about, I forget her name at the moment, but the woman who was doing the TikTok videos.
Yeah. I actually didn't, but yeah, I followed
Mary Manzovin.
Of Daf Yomi.
I follow her like every day now.
Yeah.
She's the best.
And I think it's, you
that's
know,
great.
I think
great.
It's amazing. And it you know, like my oldest daughter, who's now 18 after high school, in a pre-army academy, and she's doing Daf Yomi. And it's I find that to be amazing.
She's doing Daf Yomi
on her own.
No, nothing to do with TikTok.
No, but I mean, okay. But you know, but the
but it's like a thing. It's
but
a
like,
thing.
She's a girl who my daughter, who could wear ripped jeans.
Our kids don't do Dafyomi yet.
Well, they're young. And sit and do Dafyomi. And then there's this woman who's doing these TikTok videos, which I think is just incredible of opening up and making things more accessible. And there are people who are upset with it. And I just think it's just a great example that illustrates the just how colorful the world, the Jewish world is. So we hope that in this podcast,
amen,
you'll bring some of these characters to life for us.
From the Jewish TikTok, that's what it's called, right?
Jewish TikTok.
Yeah. What did I say?
No, I know.
Okay.
Okay, well, Tzvika, it was great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast.
It was great being here.
To start off your new journey with us at the Jerusalem Post.
And if anybody has good names or offers for this podcast,
yes,
they should let us know, right?
Yeah, just tweet them at Tzvika.
Right. Klein.
Yes, at Tzvika Klein. Klein. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, Tzvika. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's Jerusalem Post podcast. We look forward to seeing you again next week with more news and interviews. And please share. Worth can be found on all podcast platforms. Have a great week.